Please welcome Jeff Cooper, Senior Vice President of the Renewable Fuels Association.
Well, good morning. I'd like to ask Professor Babcock and Dr. Mueller to please make their way to the stage. In the meantime, I'd like to offer a few comments. Probably a bit of a stark contrast to what we just heard in relation to the RFS. Let's see here. So as you heard from Bob earlier this morning, we certainly believe that the renewable fuel standard has been among the most successful and innovative energy policies this nation has ever seen. But as we all know, and as we just heard, the program has come to what some might say is an important political crossroads. And while most of us in the room would argue that the RFS has worked and will work exactly as intended, there are some stakeholders, and we just heard from one, who believe we've gone far enough with the program. They're ready to throw in the towel because the RFS is beginning to push them out of their comfort zone. So the purpose of our panel this morning is to take a deeper dive into the current state of the RFS, review EPA's recent action and what impacts that may have on the marketplace moving forward, and discuss where we go from here. So I thought it would be useful to start by rewinding to this time last year. If you were with us at the National Ethanol Conference last year in Las Vegas, you might recall that we had a panel discussion on the RFS, and I went back and kind of looked over some of those presentations, and these were some of the key themes that emerged from last year's panel. Last February, there was clear recognition that 2013 was going to be the point of inflection for the RFS program. Because the 2013 RFS blending requirements were above the E10 blend wall, the program was, for the first time ever, going to require obligated parties to fundamentally change their behavior and their compliance strategies. We knew at that point that RIN markets would start to react. They were supposed to react. That's the point. February 4th, 2013, RINs were trading for about 25 cents apiece on the day we had this panel, which seemed like a rational and sensible response from the RIN market. And of course, we knew at this point last year that the RFS was going to face strong opposition from the oil industry. That may have turned out to be the understatement of the year. So here's what happened after NEC last year. We all remember what became known as RIN sanity, where RIN prices spiked inexplicably in March, and then settled down a little bit, and then spiked again in July. We all saw the PR circus and kind of media circus that followed these RIN spikes. We saw reform or repeal bills introduced in Congress. There were a slew of hearings in both the House and Senate. The House Energy Committee had its white paper effort. They had this Gang of Four effort where they were looking at reform options. But most importantly, we saw Big Oil really ramp up its anti-RFS campaign. And they threw multiple millions of dollars at repealing or reforming the RFS last year. And a lot of this all hinges on one study. Again, similar to E15, they went out and paid for the CRC study to get a result they wanted. In this case, they went out and hired NERA, an economic consulting firm, to generate this study that says, the markets are going to react to escalating RFS requirements by, cutting refinery runs and shorting the domestic market, and that's going to lead to higher prices and severe economic harm for consumers. So that was really the foundation of their campaign against the RFS in 2013, an intensive lobbying effort, intensive public relations and advertising effort. I mean, you all saw or heard the commercials where they have an actor playing a mechanic talking about E15, numerous lawsuits focused on the RFS, and then really this kind of all culminated last fall with a request from API and AFPM for a waiver of the RFS volumes in 2014. So here's a look at how EPA administered the RFS in 2013. In January last year, EPA proposed the 2013 renewable volume obligations. They were late in doing that. In any case, the advanced and total renewable fuel requirements that they proposed mirrored exactly what was in the legislation, so consistent with what Congress had intended for 2013. They finalized that rule in August, and the final RVOs were unchanged from the proposal. So, no real news or nothing earth-shattering with the 2013 RVOs. They did drop a hint in the 2013 final rule where they said, when we go to propose 2014, we're going to propose some adjustments to the requirements for both advanced biofuels and total renewable fuels. That didn't strike us as a big surprise because clearly EPA does have statutory waiver authority to do some things with the advanced biofuel standard, and they can lower the total by the same amount that they adjust the advanced biofuel standard. So it was kind of business as usual with the 2013 RVO. But then in October, things changed, and we saw the agency really take a U-turn, a dramatic U-turn, on the way that they had been implementing this program. This 2014 RVO proposal was leaked out onto the street before EPA was able to officially publish it, and you all remember the circus that resulted from that. The leak that was out there suggested that EPA was going to make dramatic cuts to the RFS. They confirmed that in November when they actually did publish the official proposal, and it did, in fact, include across-the-board cuts to both advanced biofuels and the total renewable fuel volumes, and in a way that was not consistent with any waiver that ever pondered before or really not consistent with their authority to waive the program. And here was their twisted logic for proposing these huge cuts to the program. They cited what they call two important realities, and I believe reality was the word our previous speaker used. You can see the first one there. They said there's limitations in the volume of ethanol that can be consumed in gasoline, a set of factors commonly referred to as the blend wall. So here you have EPA essentially attempting to codify the blend wall as a determinant for setting the annual RFS targets. But the problem is their proposed use of the general waiver authority to essentially write the blend wall into the program is clearly violative of the statutory text and clearly runs afoul of what Congress intended with this program. And here's where EPA's proposal really falls down. They somehow attempt to define supply as consumption or being applicable to consumption. And if you remember, if you kind of go back to what the Clean Air Act says, EPA can only use its general waiver authority in two very narrow cases. One is if they find that the RFS is causing severe harm to the economy or environment of the United States. And the second instance that could trigger a general waiver is if there is inadequate domestic supply of renewable fuels to fulfill the requirements. So EPA looked at those two conditions and really stretched to try and define inadequate domestic supply as somehow being applicable to what they see as inadequate ability to consume larger volumes of ethanol. Now, what's important to remember here is Congress actually considered whether distribution capacity or infrastructure should be part of a waiver consideration. There were proposals when this legislation was being crafted that did include distribution capacity, and you can see the exact wording there from one example. But Congress rejected those proposals because they knew that if distribution capacity is part of this equation, the volumes of biofuels will never grow beyond their added, kind of historical additive role in the marketplace. So, here's the real problem with using the blend wall as a criterion for waiving the program. it completely eviscerates the RIN market mechanism. And we're going to hear more about that from Professor Babcock. And by doing that, it kills the incentive to invest in infrastructure, blender pumps, E85, and beyond that, it kills the incentive to invest in cellulosic and advanced ethanol technologies. And it really results in this vicious cycle where you have a situation where if consumption capacity is determining the level of the RVO, then the RVOs will never increase. It's completely backward of how it should be. And as Bob said, it really allows the oil companies to blend only as much biofuel as they are comfortable using. So, you know, again, the reason our industry reacted the way it did to the proposal is because the proposal completely turns the purpose of the RFS on its ear. You know, even if EPA could use consumption as a waiver criterion, or achievable consumption is how they refer to it, we can still get there, and there are multiple ways to do that. The statutory requirement for 14.4 billion gallons of renewable fuel could be easily satisfied, easily met, if a strong RIN signal is in place. And here's one of many potential examples of how that could happen. Obviously you're going to consume most of that ethanol as E10. We think it's perfectly realistic to believe that we could do 500 to 700 million million gallons of ethanol in E85 and mid-level blends this year. Again, if a meaningful RIN signal is in place, we're going to see expansion in E15. And oh, by the way, we've got 1.5 billion D6 RINs sitting out there that carried into this year that we could use to shore up any shortfall. And another, 400 million biodiesel RINs that can apply to this. So, we kind of scratch our head. Here, I think perhaps the most frustrating thing about EPA's proposal and this U-turn that they're taking is this. I mean, there was evidence that RINs were working to do exactly what they were intended to do, which is expand ethanol consumption in the market. The chart there, the blue bars are monthly E85 sales volumes from Minnesota. And the red line that's laid over the top is the average RIN price for that particular month. And what you see quite clearly is that as RIN prices escalated, that allowed retailers to discount E85 relative to E10 by a larger margin. And in response, consumers increased their consumption of E85. That's exactly what this mechanism was intended to do, and it was in fact working. But then you can see what happened when RIN prices took a plunge late fall, is E85 consumption started to trail off, again, because that discount wasn't nearly as wide. So, it's been very frustrating, given that there is evidence that this program will do what it's supposed to do, that EPA has taken this approach. I wanted to just finish my remarks with just a look at, how the RFS has worked since its inception. And the bars you're looking at here on the screen illustrate the targets set forth by Congress in the 2007 Energy Bill. The blue portion is the cellulosic biofuel requirement. The red is biomass-based diesel. And the orange portion of the bar is other advanced biofuels, things like renewable diesel or sugarcane ethanol imports. And then the green portion of the bar is other renewable fuels, and that's where corn ethanol fits in. This next set of bars illustrates the actual RVOs set forth by EPA on an annual basis. And what you see here is that because cellulosic ethanol production has been slow to commercialize, EPA has kept the RFS whole by allowing other advanced biofuels, biodiesel, renewable diesel, sugarcane ethanol imports, to offset that shortfall in cellulose. So again, EPA has satisfied Congress's intent with this program and used its statutory authority to make adjustments to allow this program to work. And you can see each and every year the RVO has matched, in terms of total volume, what Congress intended. Now, this third set of bars shows what has been actually produced. And what you see here is that actual production has always met or exceeded the requirements. And the other thing you see here that's represented by the purple bars is that there has always been a large bank of surplus RIN credits because blending has always exceeded these requirements. So even in 2013, where actual corn ethanol RIN generation was a bit below the RVO because of the drought, there were more than enough excess RINs to make up that shortfall. So again, the program works. And I think if you look at 2014, what we're showing here is, you know, there's 1.7, 1.8 billion RINs that could be used toward compliance with this program. So, I mean, if we didn't blend a drop more than we did last year in terms of total biofuels, we could still meet the statutory requirements. So here's the bottom line. You know, again, the RFS has worked. The RFS will work, but only if EPA allows it to work. I think we've got a great panel lined up this morning. You may be wondering why Chris Grundler from EPA is not sitting at the head table, you've probably noted that discrepancy on the agenda. We had Chris Grundler from EPA on this panel to give us EPA's latest thoughts on RFS issues, but we heard from Mr. Grundler's office late last week that he wouldn't be able to join us today, but he will be here tomorrow, and he'll be first speaker on the agenda to give us an update from EPA's perspective. So here's the lineup we do have this morning. We're going to hear first from Iowa State professor Bruce Babcock on the impact of the RFS on investment, consumption, and fuel prices. Over the last year or so, Bruce has written more and thought more about these issues than anybody I know. I mean, just in the last year, the modeling and the writing that he has done on RFS issues is tremendous. And so we're very fortunate to have Bruce with us today. And then following Bruce, we're going to hear from Dr. Stefan Mueller from the University of Illinois Chicago. And thanks to Stefan for filling in on short notice. And he's going to share his thoughts on EPA's life cycle greenhouse gas analysis and talk about some of the problems with that analysis. We'll go from there. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce.
Good morning, and thanks a lot, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak at this conference and to share some of my observations and writings and research findings regarding the feasibility of meeting expanded ethanol targets and the impact of meeting those targets on fuel prices. EPA's proposal to reduce ethanol mandates, as Jeff indicated, to about 13 billion gallons, as I read it, it seems to be predicated on two beliefs. The first is that consumers will not consume more ethanol than contained in E10. I think you heard that opinion very eloquently explained by a Marathon speaker. So that's the first idea. The second idea is that if EPA tries to force ethanol consumption beyond E10 levels, then retail fuel prices will increase significantly. I think you also heard that from the Marathon speaker in terms of their choice whether to export gasoline and that the RIN value is a marginal cost to them, incremental cost of production. And I think both of these beliefs have been reinforced by extensive lobbying campaigns by the oil industry trade groups and executives. And I read those like all of you did, and I started wondering if there was really any economic validity to these arguments. And so I got a smart colleague of mine, Sebastian Pouliot, who's an assistant professor and smarter than me about how to model things and how to create data. And I'm a little smarter than him on what we ought to be thinking about. So we wrote a series of research papers to look at whether or not there is actually any validity to these beliefs. And so what I want to do today is kind of summarize some of the findings. I think some of our research paper was referred to earlier as billions of gallons of E85 could just magically be consumed by consumers. And I think you'll see, what I hope to do is you get a better appreciation for some of the work that we did on that. The big green arrow, that makes sense, isn't it? Okay, so let's get started here. So I think Jeff did a good idea. So let's just start with fundamentals so that when I get into a little bit more, we know we're all on the same level. So how is the RFS supposed to work? The first thing is a clear roadmap. Make everyone, and I think if all of you have ever gone to any RFS lecture, you've seen the volume mandates go up almost in a linear fashion until they hit 15 billion gallons and then they're flat. And then cellulosic is supposed to take after. But there is no surprise, since the Energy Act was passed, that 14.4 billion gallons was the target in 2014 and 15 billion gallons was the target in 2015. This was supposed to signal to everybody that these are the targets and it's the law of the land. So a clear signal about what the blending targets are supposed to be has been a key part of the RFS. Flexibility was also part of the RFS, and it included both volume flexibility in case the supply of fuel wasn't as great as potentially as envisioned back in 2007. And clearly the cellulosic production of biofuel has trailed badly, not badly, but it's trailed significantly. So the reality is different. The reality of the volumes are much lower than what the targets were. But EPA has in the RFS the authority to have flexibility to reduce those volume mandates. So that flexibility is key. The other flexibility that's key is that the Congress passed a market-based mechanism to create the incentives for investment that would then, and consumption and investment, to allow the clear targets to be met. And that's the market for RINs. EPA, in that market for RINs, also the flexibility in banking RINs to carry over, like Jeff indicated, or borrowing RINs from the future in case the compliance costs were too high. So clear roadmap, flexibility on volumes, and flexibility in a market-based mechanism was how the RFS was supposed to work. It's envisioned that that's the way it's supposed to work. So a little bit of theory. I'm an economist, so we have to have a little theory here. So here is, for those of you wondering, what is all this RIN value and how does RIN create incentive? So the theory of the RIN is that a RIN price closes any gap between the price that is needed to get consumers to want to consume ethanol, the demand pull model. So the RIN price, there is a price of ethanol where consumers will want to buy it. So if that price is lower than the cost of producing ethanol and getting it to the consumer, the RIN value is supposed to close that gap. It does close that gap. That's the theory of RIN value. So anything that changes that gap will change the RIN value. So high production costs of corn ethanol, that'll increase the RIN value. Low production costs will reduce it. High consumer demand will decrease the RIN value. Low consumer demand will increase it. That's the theory. That's how RINs are supposed to work. So I give an example, a concrete example, because a lot of what I have found or based my research on is this relationship between the RIN value, the production cost of ethanol, and the demand for ethanol. So I got an example here. And my example is, suppose that we have an E10 price of $3.30 per gallon. That's a pump price that consumers pay at the pump. And now, further suppose, and I'm using an E85 example here, suppose that you're an owner of a flex vehicle, and to make it worth your while to fill that flex vehicle up with E85, and you happen to have an E85 station available to you, that you want that E85 priced at $2.55 a gallon. Okay, so that's a retail price of E85, and you'll go and fill up your tank with E85. And if I assume there's a 75-cent wholesale to retail markup, and what that means is that the blender needs ethanol priced inexpensively at the wholesale level. That blender needs $1.55 ethanol to create a low enough price of E85, wholesale price of E85, to be able to sell it to the retail outlet at $255 to get the consumer to buy the E85. Okay? So we need $1.55 ethanol. And I'm going to assume throughout this, economists, they without assumptions, we'd be dead. But I'm going to assume that markets are competitive. I don't know any of you out there who don't think that you're not in a competitive industry, and so it's a pretty a safe assumption, I think, that we're competitive markets. Okay, so what I did then is calculate how one goes about making E85 price competitive so that the consumer will demand the fuel. And so you do that through D6 RIN values. So what I have on the horizontal axis there, hope you can see that, is that the cost, that's the cost of producing and transporting ethanol to a blender who creates the E85. Okay, so then on the vertical axis is the RIN price. And to remind you, we need a pump price of $255 and an E10 price of $330. So let's consider an example. Let's suppose that corn fell in price dramatically to, say, $3.50 a gallon. Essentially, that would mean that you could get corn ethanol to the blender at $1.50. Well, $1.50 is less than that $1.55 that you need the E85 to be priced at, so the RIN value is zero. More realistically, let's say that ethanol, the cost of producing and transporting ethanol is $1.75. That corresponds to more like $4.10 corn, something like that. Then you need a RIN value of 20 cents to make E85 competitive. It closes that gap. Then at $2 corn, I think that's probably where, $2 corn, I'm sorry. Heaven forbid we go to $2 corn, except for the ethanol plants, they might make a little money. But $2 ethanol, then that corresponds, and I think that's about where we are today, $2 to $2.20. That corresponds to RIN values between 45 and 65 cents. So again, there's an inverse relationship between the cost of production of ethanol and the RIN value needed to induce the drivers of E85 to demand the fuel. So I just set this up because this is how the market for RINs works, how the theory of RIN value determination works, and this is how the demand is supposed to materialize for E85 is through the RIN value. And I think Jeff's graph in Minnesota illustrated this. So there's some key questions that I tried to address in my research. It's, can ethanol consumption be increased through E85, or is it a failed fuel? I don't think it's a failed fuel. I don't think it's been priced right. Well, what price of E85 is needed to get consumers to buy it? And how much ethanol can actually be feasibly consumed at E85 given the current infrastructure and given investment? So share some findings with you. So the first question is, we cannot go back in time to look at the data to show whether or not consumers will buy E85 for the simple reason that E85 has not been priced at a level to get consumers to want to buy it. Those consumers with flex vehicles, if they even see an E85 station, the price historically, as we see here in Minnesota, has been priced above the level that is needed to make sense for them to buy the fuel. The red line here is the fuel cost parity line, which is the price of E85 relative to E10, where it breaks even in terms of miles per gallon. As you can see, even in Minnesota, the E85 price for almost the whole time period has been above the price where it makes sense for consumers to buy it. If you want consumers to buy something, you got to make it a good deal for them. You need that blue line to go below the fuel cost parity line, or at least equal to it. So instead of looking at Minnesota data, what we did is we went to a place where consumers are used to making a choice between high blends, in fact, 100% blends, and gasoline or lower blends. And that's in Brazil. So what I have here is a curve that basically shows the willingness or proclivity of Brazilians to buy E100. So on the horizontal axis, you didn't know you were going to have to get into a lot of charts here, but on the horizontal axis is that fuel cost ratio. And that's the fuel cost ratio, the price of E100 divided by the price of gasoline in Brazil, and it's adjusted for miles per gallon. So when you're above one, that means ethanol is more expensive. And then on the vertical axis is the proportion of people, of Brazilians, who buy E100. So as ethanol costs you money to fill up, fewer Brazilians buy it. No surprise. As the price of ethanol drops relative to gasoline, you get a tremendous response of people who do buy it, and you can see that we can draw the fuel parity line at one. About 40% of flex fuel vehicle owners in Brazil will buy E100 when it's priced at parity. If it's priced below parity, you can see the dramatic upswing in the demand for the fuel. When it's dry, when ethanol is priced below parity, you can see that people won't buy it. So it's really, price is a key feature, which to an economist makes sense, right? If you want someone to buy your product, price it where it makes sense for them to buy it. So what we did, of course, is we wanted to look at the potential demand. Well, the potential demand for E85 is zero if you don't own a flex vehicle. So the first step we had to do was go and find where the flex vehicles were. So this is a zip code map of where the flex vehicles were. And to make it easier, what I did is I created a state-by-state number where the flex vehicles are. For in the United States, if you wanted to sell E85, one would think that you would want to go where the consumers are. Well, the consumers are in Texas, California, Florida, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, so you see some big Midwestern states there, but the top three states for flex vehicle owners are Texas, California, and Florida. Then after you get past the big Midwestern, the manufacturing belt, you see New York, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Georgia, North Carolina, not exactly E85 places where there's lots of E85 stations. So what we wanted to do is be realistic about matching up where the cars are, the flex vehicles are, and where the stations are. So, but the first thing we wanted to do was, let's suppose that E85 was as widely available as E10. And you priced it accordingly. What this curve shows is that if you price E85 at fuel cost parity and E85 is as widely available as E10, we calculate that you'd get about 2.5 billion gallons of ethanol consumption in E85. Now, why 2.5 billion gallons is important? Remember, if E10 is 13 billion gallons, 13.4 according to Jeff, but 13, the target's 15, you can see that 2.5, it could get you there. And if you lower the price to make it a good deal for consumers, you could get up to 6 billion gallons. Maybe this is what the graph that was referred to as billions of gallons of consumption. But if we then look at the reality, E85 is not available everywhere. You can see it's mostly available up in the upper Midwest. If you go to where the flex vehicles are, Florida, Texas, and California, there's very few E85 stations available, and they haven't priced it at anywhere near the price that is needed to get those owners of flex fuel vehicles to buy it. So what we did is that we calculated the distance from every flex fuel station to every flex fuel vehicle to every flex E85 station, and we calculated there's about 5 million FFVs within 5 miles of a station. So those are kind of the feasible set of flex vehicles that could potentially purchase E85. And then we looked at the reality of how much volume of E85 could go through the system, and we came up with this demand chart. This is the amount of ethanol that could be consumed in E85 with no investment in new infrastructure and no new flex fuel vehicles. And you see at about, if you priced it at parity, we estimate about 600 million gallons. If you discounted it, you can see that you could get up to 800 million gallons. So essentially, which agrees with what Jeff put out there, it's completely feasible to meet a 14.4 billion gallon mandate with about 700 million gallons of E85 if it was priced accordingly without any new investment. But of course, if you priced it accordingly low, you would get excess demand. And so what if we needed to go beyond that? Well, it would make sense for fuel retailers to invest in E85 in places where the flex fuel vehicles are. So what we did is we identified where demand for E85 could materialize, and you can see that if we wanted to optimize where you would put the stations, you would put them in the places where the flex fuel vehicles were. So then we said, okay, well, the RFS is supposed to force investment. If this is the type of investment in fuel distribution for E85 that we could get, what would be the impact on demand? So we said, okay, let's put on 500 stations, 1,000 stations, 1,500 and 3,500 stations, and let's price the fuel so it makes sense for consumers to buy it. So you can see the last chart, the last line there shows you the amount of ethanol that could be consumed if you put 3,500 new E85 stations in locations where the flex vehicles were. And you can see that we calculate at parity, or if you priced it a little bit below parity, you could get 2 billion gallons of E85 consumed. Again, the consumption would follow the investment. The question becomes, why will these new stations magically appear? You heard our previous speaker, consumers don't want the fuel. Well, it's the RFS is supposed to work to create the incentive for investment to take place to create the demand. So, and that's done through RIN prices. So high RIN prices, just like any other high corn prices, create an incentive to get more RINs. Well, how do you get more RINs? The two fuels that are out there, E85 and E15. So to get more RINs, you have to stimulate more consumption. So the value of the RINs generated by inducing more consumption is much, much greater than the cost of investment by our calculations. So the RIN market creates the incentives by having the refineries try to avoid compliance costs with the RFS to reduce their compliance costs by investing in the infrastructure needed to lower the RIN value and increase demand for the fuels. That's how the RFS is supposed to work. The E10 infrastructure build-out is the model. Before 2005 and 2006, we had another blend wall. It was the E5 blend wall or the E6 blend wall. That is, vast parts of the country could not consume E10. How did that infrastructure get built out? Because there was an incentive to create the infrastructure, and instead of a high RIN price creating the incentive, it was a tax credit, and the VTEC created the incentive. It's the same idea with the new infrastructure. Okay, so last thing I want to do is look at the impact of RIN prices on consumers and refineries. So I agree 100% with our previous speaker that RIN values are an incremental cost of production to refineries. And here's the cost increase. You calculate it as the RVO percentage times the RIN price. For example, 11-cent cost increase would be an 11% RVO times a dollar RIN price. So keep the round number. So it is an 11-cent increase in RIN value or production cost. That cost increase, as any cost increase will do to a refinery, will reduce the supply of gasoline that refineries provide. That reduction in supply will cause wholesale gasoline prices to rise by less than the cost increase. We calculate about 8 cents. So about 8 cents, a dollar RIN would translate into about an 8 cent increase in wholesale gasoline prices. I think this is consistent with the story that we were just told. The problem is that consumers, if you look at the impact on consumers, they don't consume pure gasoline. They consume E10. And so the gasoline component increases by about 7 cents a gallon. I know I'm getting a little caught in the weeds here, but remember that that dollar RIN is creating lower cost ethanol for consumers. And a 10% blend, a dollar RIN, I can do the arithmetic, 0.1 times a dollar, that lowers the price of E10 by 10 cents. So you got gasoline price go up, ethanol down, the net effect on the gasoline price is a slight decrease in the E10 price from, ironically, a $1 increase in RINs. That's the way it's supposed to work, and that's the way we think that it would work. So here's we think that, in fact, you even when you have a RIN value going up, as the lower chart shows, we would see the retail price of gasoline staying constant. So that's what I wanted to say. Just want to conclude that I think that we're at a key turning point, and I think if the administration is serious about increasing the amount of renewable fuels, now is the time to do it. If they ever think that Congress is going to pass a law that is requiring investment to be made in the future, and if they allow the blend wall to determine the level of ethanol that will be consumed domestically, then we can just multiply the total gasoline consumption by 10% and then just freeze the mandate there and then go about our business by looking at alternative markets. I think that if the Congress and administration want to follow the fact that we want to replace fossil gasoline with renewable fuels, I think EPA really needs to revisit this this mandate just to maintain credibility with the laws that they pass in the future. With that, I think that was a pretty well summarized what I've found out.
As Stefan makes his way to the podium, I'm just going to let folks know that we will have some time for your questions following Dr. Mueller's presentation. So if you have some questions for Professor Babcock or Stefan Mueller, be thinking of those, and we'll entertain a few questions. Go ahead, Stefan.
Okay. So press the green button here. Take one. Okay. Well, thanks for having me. So we've heard a lot about infrastructure from Marathon Oil, and we've heard a lot about pricing from Professor Babcock. And I think that's important, right? It's not as important to me as the following. The RFS2 was also established to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and provide climate mitigation through the use of biofuels, through the increased use of biofuels. And I think biofuels are doing a tremendous job in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and we should not forget about it. And a lot of my research centers on these issues. So when I went to Washington, D.C. in December, I testified, and some of my key points that I testified on are here. The RFS2 works as intended. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions relative to petroleum. Biofuels industry has a very high rate of technology adoption, much higher than you see in other sectors, much higher than you see in the general oil sector, a high rate of technology adoption, and that reduces the greenhouse gas balance and the overall environmental balance of that fuel. And the RFS2 worked as intended, and it encourages the adoption of these technologies and will so in the future. So in my presentation, I'm going to go a little bit in the baseline, greenhouse gas emission baseline, carbon intensity baseline of petroleum-based fuels, and then compared to corn ethanol, and where, in which direction are they're heading. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about my issues with the RFS2 analysis and the need to redo the analysis at this point in time where so much new science has been developed. So basically, it's a long and wordy slide. All we sort of need to remember here is the petroleum mix going forward will be heavily weighted by tight oils, by fracking, by Canadian tar sands. There's some mitigation because of gas to liquids, admittedly, but overall, we will be going towards higher carbon intensity fuels in the baseline. This is a picture of the Bracken, the fracking area. You can see at night the flaring, and that is greenhouse gas emissions, right? So you can see on this slide how tight oils, fracking, etc., and the U.S. Petroleum-based mix at much higher rates than previously. And the greenhouse gas emission of these tight oils, or unconventional oils, as they're that usually called, have higher greenhouse gas emissions, higher carbon intensity values, compared to our petroleum mix that we had in the past. So the baseline will go towards higher carbon intensity fuels in the future for petroleum. How does it look on the biofuel side? Well, one of the key issues in the biofuels debate is land use change. And I've researched extensively on land use change since Searchinger came out with a penalty of over 100 grams per megajoule. So to recap, land use change is a penalty that's assigned to biofuels production based on the assumption that a shock, you know, that is driven by increased biofuels policy in the U.S., that shock will rattle through the export markets. We produce more domestic fuel feedstock, biofuels feedstock, and then the export markets will make up any fuel feedstock that is not being imported and produce it themselves. So what we've seen in this space is that the longer we study it and the better we develop our databases as scientists, the lower this international land use change penalty or penalty adder has become, right? It is now settled among several studies that it's not 100 grams per megajoule, it's actually less than 10 grams per megajoule. So that factor, that penalty factor, has come down by a factor of 10. I've been involved working closely with Argonne's National GREET model, GREET Life Cycle model, which is sort of the gold standard for modeling these effects in the U.S., and updated that model significantly, or was co-author in updating it, and released our spatially explicit factors. So we look at, on a county-by-county basis, we're looking at the carbon adjustments from corn production and from other feedstock production, other cellulosic feedstock production, corn stover to ethanol production, switchgrass, and with Kansas. What we found is that the land use change is less than 10 grams per megajoule. Just this week, we issued yet another model with other co-authors, a whole new look on land use change model, and we came out with close to the same results, less than 10 gram per megajoule for land use adder, which compares to the 28 grams per megajoule that EPA currently still assigns to corn-based ethanol fuels, and 30 grams per megajoule that CARB assigns to corn starch ethanol fuel. In addition, as I also mentioned in my testimony, the industry, the ethanol industry, has a very high rate of technology adoption. When I tour plants, there's always some sort of retrofit going on, some technology being implemented that made that plant more effective, increases yield, reduces energy consumption on a per unit output, better heat integration, a whole host of new technologies going in, new enzymes being developed that reduces overall emissions. So it's a very dynamic industry. So this whole presentation was basically done in cooperation with Life Cycle Associates, and I think Bob Denin mentioned the report earlier on, and I have provided some input to that study off and on. And when we look at that slide, we see that going forward, or what is emerging in the science, is that we have to really look at the corn plant as the sort of the origin for multiple fuel and feed products, right? So out of the corn plant, we can produce starch, ethanol, and then DDG on the back end. But from the corn stover that can be sustainably removed, we can produce cellulosic ethanol and corn replacement feed. In addition, we can also produce some additional cellulosic ethanol from corn kernel fiber. So these are the main products, right? And we got to keep them together, right? It's one plant producing all these products. We have to do proper co-product accounting for that. But if we do it, we come to a very impressive conclusion here that corn ethanol goes to 39 grams per megajoule. And that is the fuels, the cellulosic ethanol, and the cellulosic ethanol from the corn stover, and the starch ethanol, and the corn replacement feed from the same plant credited as co-product. We are really going down to 39 grams per megajoule, which compares quite favorably to the 97 grams per megajoule of the petroleum baseline. That's an over 60% reduction in greenhouse gas emission, which is quite impressive. The RFS2, obviously, when it was first established, was relying what is by now outdated science. We have to make a plea to EPA to rerun the numbers. There's a lot of new science available now to them that wasn't there. And back then, you know, it was not mostly their fault. I mean, the models weren't there, the database weren't quite there. But now we have good sound industry data and we have good sound modeling data. And we need to rerun the results. So for example, right, what I've pointed out, the petroleum baseline will move slightly up from 93 to 97 grams CO2 per megajoule in a revised look. Land use change emissions should significantly move down from currently 28 grams per megajoule to below 10 grams per megajoule. We need to credit emerging practices such as corn stover removal. We need to look at new technologies that have been going in and reducing chemical inputs. Nitrification inhibitors are being applied to the fields. There's technologies like energen emerging that has a potential to produce ethanol more efficiently. Obviously, the whole farming sector has started to produce the crop in a much more efficient way with new tractors, GPS tractors, etc. All of these life cycle modeling variables have to be incorporated, and actually they have been incorporated into the latest GREET model by and large, but EPA needs to pick up that latest GREET model as their starting point in their modeling efforts. The data is there now. Here in summary, right? Petroleum baseline by 2022 is not 93 grams per megajoule, it goes up to 97 grams per megajoule. So as petroleum baseline in the future goes up to higher levels, the greenhouse gas baseline of corn ethanol goes down to 39 grams per megajoule, which means we have a 60% saving in greenhouse gas emissions over petroleum fuels. And again, so the circle comes back. I hear a lot of talk about infrastructure and, you know, struggles from Marathon and, you know, and from RFA, and I see it. But if we are serious about climate change, or if we are appealing to people that are serious about climate change, this is the main argument, right? If we're serious about climate change, we are going to be overcoming the infrastructure efforts, because we have to, because we feel strongly that it is good for the environment. Yeah, this concludes my talk. Thanks.
Okay, we are going to go ahead and open it up to questions. We've got maybe 10 minutes or so for questions. So if you've got a burning question for Professor Babcock or Dr. Mueller, please make your way to one of the microphones in the aisles, and I'll do my best to see out there. It's kind of hard with these bright lights shining in my eyes. And while we wait for questioners to get lined up, I've got a question that I'd like to ask Professor Babcock. I referenced this study that was conducted by NERA on behalf of API earlier this morning. And again, that whole study is predicated on the idea that refiners are going to intentionally cut their production of gasoline and diesel, or they're going to massively ramp up exports in order to minimize their RIN exposure. I know you've looked at that study, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on whether that's a reasonable, you know, hypothesis or not.
Well, on the surface, it seems quite reasonable. I mean, if they are faced with a mandate that they can't meet, how are they going to meet it? Well, they'll reduce the mandate by cutting the amount of renewable gasoline that they actually sell domestically, which reduces the number of RINs that they need. The problem is, as soon as they did that, imagine, if you will, that they cut gasoline supply by 10% in the United States. The price of gasoline is quite sensitive to the quantity of gasoline supplied. A 10% cut in gasoline would raise the domestic price of gasoline by about 40%. Suddenly, instead of $2.60 wholesale gasoline, you just increase that by 40%, which is $1.20, we'd have $3.80 gasoline. The refineries then would say, oh, do I export it at $2.40 or do I sell gasoline domestically at $3.80? There's a big gap between the price of exports and the price of domestic gasoline. I think they would try to find a way to increase the number of RINs that they could sell in order to start selling $3.80 gasoline. If it makes sense for one refinery to do it, I think all the refineries would do it, and then competition would work to increase the number of RINs that were available. That is a more profitable strategy. I think the conclusion that they would cut the supply of gasoline just doesn't square with how commodity markets work.
Thank you. We're going to go to the center aisle there. Go ahead, sir.
I think this question would be for Dr. Mueller. And my question does not reference the use of corn stalks for cellulosic ethanol, but rather it would be, my question to you is going to revolve around the ability of corn, as well as all other green plants, that in the growing process, the plants, and I'll refer to corn, takes in carbon dioxide, converts some of the carbon dioxide to carbon and glucose, and creates the plant, which in turn creates the corn. My question is, during this respiration process, oxygen is expired, takes in carbon dioxide, expires oxygen. I spoke with some Monsanto folks this morning at a meeting, and they said that there's a relationship to calculate the amount of carbon dioxide that's been taken in, but they were going to get to me on the amount of oxygen expired. My question for you, Dr. Mueller, is in all this talk of greenhouse gases, are we as corn growers getting any credit for creating the oxygen that everyone in the world needs?
It's done correctly in life cycle analysis, right? You're getting a credit during the life cycle modeling process for binding carbon, right, in carbohydrates, and then when those are being combusted, you're releasing the CO2 again. So the life cycle modeling flows pretty well, right? And because it's biogenic carbon, right, where we are assigning the amount of CO2 that is captured by the plant during a growing season, and then it's combusted, you know, commensurately as that fuel becomes available within a well-defined time frame, and then, which is usually a year, and so we're assigning the life cycle to that process. So it's pretty well established how, the CO2 works here. Now for petroleum-based fuels, obviously the CO2, the carbon, is the fossil carbon, and that's a net addition to the atmosphere, and that's also counted that way.
I'm not sure if I understood. My main concern is the oxygen that is released and separated from the carbon dioxide. Are we as corn growers getting credit for putting oxygen into the atmosphere?
No. I'll the whole focus of life cycle analysis is on CO2 because of the greenhouse gas warming. It's not on oxygen. No one's made that calculation, I don't think, and I'm not sure what the value would be in terms of the oxygen and what the baseline would be without corn or with corn. So I don't think the question has actually been addressed by the life cycle analysis.
And my last point would be, and I think that's the slam in the face to us corn growers. Everybody breathes what our plants give off, and apparently it's not been filled in. Thank you.
Thanks. Next question. Go ahead.
Hey, Jeff. Bob Greco, American Petroleum Institute. Just two questions today. First for Dr. Mueller. Bob Dineen, I believe you as well, compared average GHG emissions from corn or from ethanol refineries to marginal GHG emissions from oil production. That would be an apples to oranges comparison. Have you looked at average to average emissions, marginal to marginal? And then for Dr. Babcock, on a recent RFA blog, it was posted that the reduction of the 2014 RFS by 1.4 billion gallons would lead to a $7 billion increase in gas prices and a $10 billion in additional profits to oil companies. Can you reconcile how such a reduction has such an outsized impact? Thank you.
Well, I take the marginal question. So if I look at the marginal petroleum mix, right, so that's the mix that's coming in with tight oils being used, tar sands being used particularly, but also in all openness GTL being used. So that's the marginal mix going in, which will on average likely have a higher carbon intensity going forward than in the past. I mean, we all know California already adjusted their mix upwards, right? One would expect EPA to do the same thing. But on the ethanol side, right, the marginal plant, as I pointed out, is an ever more modern plant, right? So the ethanol produced from the latest plants that have been built is probably one of the cleanest ethanol that's out there because it presumably employs the most modern technologies. Other plants obviously have been retrofitted, but the marginal plant is obviously the most efficient one.
I have a understand, obviously, we're upstream oil and gas does not presumably deploy the latest technology. So I understand your point there.
And Bob, if I could just add to that before Bruce answers your other question. The study that both Stefan and Bob Dineen referenced this morning, they do show those comparisons of average corn ethanol to average petroleum. That reduction is 32%. The average corn ethanol compared to marginal petroleum is a 37 to 40% reduction. And then to Stefan's point, if you're comparing marginal corn ethanol, the new corn ethanol that's entering the system, to the marginal petroleum, that reduction is even higher. It's like 42 to 45%. So again, all the assumptions and data behind those numbers are in that report.
Okay. 1.4 billion gallon reduction in blending of ethanol. If in fact that occurred domestically, it would reduce the RIN value a lot, let's say 50 cents, 50 cents per RIN. And if you had 13 billion RINs, my calculation would be $6.5 billion reduction in RIN revenue. So that's the closest thing I can come to your number of where the blog on RFA came from. I didn't create that number, and I don't ascribe to the oil industry thinking that that is an actual impact on profit, because you have the market changes in the price of gasoline from the RIN market coming in, and also you have to take into account what parts of the oil industry are you talking about? Only refiners or transportation, blenders, retailers? So I don't know where that number came from, and it wasn't one of my numbers.
Maybe Jeff knows, since it's an RFA number, not an oil and gas number.
Well, I mean, it basically looked at the elasticity of the price elasticity of what happens when you take a billion plus gallons of, call it gasoline, call it ethanol. What happens when you take that out of the supply? What is the response to gasoline prices? You heard Bruce comment earlier that gasoline prices are highly sensitive to even small changes in supply. So we can talk further offline about that analysis. Let's have the next question, please.
I'm a corn producer and also an ethanol producer, and I noted in this is for Professor Babcock. I noticed in your presentation that there was a 70-cent profit margin at which the retailers were willing to do business. That was a minimum, and I was my question, or I guess I'd be interested in your thoughts, how we could move our industries towards that business model where we just have a minimum profit margin at which we'll do business.
Okay, let's be clear. That was a remember that assumption I had in there about competition? I'm assuming that there are no excess profits at all between blenders and retailers. That is, that that markup is pure cost. And that 75 cents is the amount that is needed to compensate all parties for all their costs and a normal profit, not a guaranteed profit by any means. In fact, it assumes what economists call normal profits, enough to keep you in the business. So there is no and that 75 cents came from just by looking at national average wholesale to retail markups on gasoline.
We've got time for one more, so go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Howard Marks with Energetics, a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy, Bioenergy Technologies Office. My question is Professor Mueller, and that is you provided some very impressive statistics on the reduction of different carbon and pollutants first-generation ethanol, corn ethanol. Could you just discuss the impact on cleaner air? After all, the whole RFS was set up under the Clean Air Act amendments, and